User disconnected from your channel.
Where is the bill of your mother's divorcement? Because they really didn't have a bill of divorcement except in the prophet Hosea.
So, Martin, you're reading?
I believe so.
So we're at, I just started recording.
We're at Isaiah 50, verse 1. Thus saith Yahweh, where is the bill of your mother's divorcement, whom I have put away? Or which of my creditors is it to whom I have sold you? Behold, for your iniquities have ye sold yourselves, and for your transgressions is your mother put away. Wherefore, when I came and was there no man, when I called, was there none to answer? Is my hand shortened at all?
Microphone muted.
That it cannot redeem? Or have I no power to deliver? Behold, at my rebuke I dry up the sea. I make the rivers a wilderness. Their fish stinketh, because there is no water, and dieth for thirst. I clothe the heavens with blackness, and I make sackcloth their covering. The Lord God hath given me the tongue of the learned, that I should know how to speak a word in season to him that is weary. He wakeneth morning. By morning he wakeneth mine ear to hear as the learned. The Lord God hath opened mine ear, and I was not rebellious, neither turned away back. I gave my back to the smiters, and my cheeks to them that plucked off the hair. I hid not my face from shame and spitting. For the Lord God will help me. Therefore shall I not be confounded. Therefore have I set my face like a flint, and I know that I shall not be ashamed. He is near that justifieth me. Who will contend with me? Let us stand together. Who is mine adversary? Let him who come near me to me. Behold, the Lord God will help me. Who is he that shall condemn me? Lo, they all shall wax old as a garment. The moths shall eat them up. Who is among you that feareth Yahweh, that obeyeth the voice of this servant, that walketh in darkness and hath no light? Let him trust in the name of Yahweh and stay upon his God.
And 11 verses. We done?
Okay. 10.
10 is 11 verses.
I didn't scroll down that far. Verse 11. Behold, all ye that kindle a fire, that compass yourselves about with sparks, walk in the light of your fire and in the sparks that ye have kindled. This shall ye have of mine hand. Ye shall lie down in sorrow.
I don't know what you're reading from, but a little tip is to see how many verses we got so you figure out how to split it up when you're reading. Donna was pretty good at that. I know that you're used to reading the whole chapter. Sometimes reading the whole chapter is kind of cumbersome if we want to have any discussion, and we want to discuss something in the beginning of the chapter, but we have to read 37 verses to get to it. That's just too much, right? I'm sorry, it just is. But especially here, I believe it was, I'm thinking it was Ezekiel chapter 23. It's been a while since I've wrote on this. But Ezekiel chapter 23 is basically the divorce decree between Yahweh and Judah. So the only place the divorce is announced, but where it's clear to me, is in Ezekiel chapter 23, where he's saying that he's alienated because Judah, if you look at verse 31 of Ezekiel chapter 23, because Judah walked in the way of thy sister. who the sister in verse 28 was alienated from God. And in verse 31, Judah walked in the way of thy sister. Thou shalt drink of thy sister's cup deep and large. So Israel was divorced from Yahweh, and that divorce was declared in Hosea chapters 1 and 2. But in Ezekiel chapter 23, it's declared of Judah. The same divorce. And the British Israel people and the old-time CI people that claim that Judah was never divorced are full of shit. Read Ezekiel chapter 23. It's right there in black and white. And that's enough, as far as I'm concerned, that Yahweh divorced Judah as much as Israel, because Judah would drink of the cup of the sister, meaning Israel, full and large. So where is the bill of your mother's divorcement, whom I have put away? And it's true that Yahweh never wrote a bill of divorce like you see a man have to do for a woman in ancient Israel. But he did announce that divorce in Ezekiel and in Hosea. But Isaiah was writing and prophesying not long after Hosea and long before Ezekiel. So even if the words are in the prophet Hosea, that doesn't mean the children of Israel could come up with them and say, here's my divorce. They didn't have one. They sold themselves into slavery for their sin. And that's described several times in the prophets. There's something that's interesting here that I see that shows how cold and how cruel the ancient world could be compared to our Christian world. And that's the next line. Of which of my creditors is it to whom I have sold you? So I could go to the bank and get a $10,000 credit line of credit and spend it all and not be able to repay it and tell the banker, hey, you want my wife? You can have my wife. And if the banker agrees, then he'd settle the debt. That's the way the ancient world was like. In our Christian world, we can't conceive of that. And we would think that's evil, and it is evil. But in the ancient world, it was normal. It was a matter of course. To which of my creditors is it to whom I have sold you? If I owe you $10,000 and I say, hey, I really don't want my wife. You want to take her? She's kind of pretty. And you say, yeah, and you settle the debt. That's the ancient world. We, having been raised all our life as Christians, even in this fucked up modern world, because it is fucked up in a lot of ways. America is fucked in a lot of ways. But it's still not as bad as the ancient world, where you could just sell your wife to settle the debt. So that's what Yahweh's asking Israel here. Or which of my creditors is it to whom I have sold you? And of course, he didn't sell them at all. They sold themselves for their sin. So even with simple little verses like that, a lot about the ancient world can be revealed. And that if you read the Greek classics, and especially the epic poetry, that is often the way it worked. That people took each other for granted, and they took each other so cheaply, where we as Christians have been raised to value one another, at least to some degree, and to value our wives. Back in 5,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, it was way different, especially with the pagans. So basically here he's challenging the children of Israel and putting the blame on them that they were separated from the kingdom and they were brought into captivity. And when they suffer injury, it's him, the husband, is being reproached. When some man comes and beats up your wife, and you can't do anything about it, it's the husband that's being reproached. Or if you don't do anything about it, it's the husband that's being disgraced. So the Assyrians come and take Israel and take Israel into captivity. It's really Yahweh that's being disgraced. And that's why it says, I gave my back to the smiters, to them that plucked off the hair. That Yahweh is describing himself as being disgraced. because of the behavior of the children of Israel. And that's what happened. That's the way that works. So that actually became literally true in Yahshua Christ.
Now, does that tie in with the whole, yeah, I think that there's the verse where it says, talks about being purchased without price.
That's what redemption's all about.
User entered your channel.
The children of Israel sold themselves into sin. So it says, and I'm going to look it up real quick. In Isaiah chapter 52, which is only two chapters from now, we'll probably hit on it tonight. You have sold yourselves for naught, because they sold themselves into sin, so they will be redeemed without money. Nothing explains the gospel better than these final 26 chapters of Isaiah and the Gospel of John. And you can put it all together just with those two. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke have their value, but if you go from the last 26 chapters of Isaiah, the Gospel of John, you should be able to tell the whole story and understand it's all about race too. You really should.
So purchase without price, or purchase without money, but with the blood of Christ.
Of course. There was something else I wanted to hit on here. I think it slipped away from me. Oh, they shall all wax old as a garment. The moth shall eat them up in verse 9. In other words, all of the enemies of Yahweh, who are also the enemies of his people, even when they don't know it, that they are all going to just disappear. That was quoted by Paul in Hebrews chapter 1. In verse 11, they shall perish, but you remain. They shall all wax old as does a garment.
Microphone activated.
But you'll remain. It's a guarantee that Israelite Christians have, that we will remain, and all of the enemies of our God, who are also our enemies, even when we don't fucking know it, because most of these Judeo-Christians don't know it, they're all going to disappear. And most of the Judeo-Christians are going to be upset that they no longer have their Jews and their niggers, but they're going to have to deal with it.
Hold on, I got a question for you. Verse 1 of your mother, Strong's 517, Imicum of your mother.
I'm sorry,
in 50 verse, chapter 50, verse 1, where it says of your mother, that's Strong's 517.
Okay.
Okay, I've got a question about that. I think you said once that the Greeks use a similar word. Right now, I can't access my Greek thing, like the Septuagint. But Is that the same similar word that Greeks use for mother, or of your mother? Something like makam, mikam?
This bill, that's divorcement of your mother. That word is just AM.
Yeah, I mean, as a phrase, like a, I guess it's like a verbal phrase.
Shellac, am, shellac, kind of weird. Okay, sent away comes with the word shellac.
So I mean the phrase of your mother.
Yeah, the phrase of your mother. Comes from Aleph, Aleph, M. That's Samek. And mem again. Okay. Aleph mem kaf? No, that can't be a kaf. Some of these fucking letters are so crazy. Yeah, I guess it is a kaf.
User entered your channel.
I go look in Strong's Concordance for actual transliteration, because I don't. Strong's just gives me the transliteration of the root. But it's basically a word for mother that is not that similar to the Greek word mater.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I meant. Okay, that's right. I thought it was Makam or Mikam. Yeah, it's Mater, yeah, okay. I'm putting together...
The Greek word for mother is Mater, and so is the Latin.
Yeah, it's the same in Slavic languages, right? So that's why I'm still making that alphabet list. And when I was reading this, because they also say Mikam, Mika or Mikem for mother, right? Depending on, like, if it's the tense.
User disconnected from your channel.
Well, I don't know where they're getting it from.
Well, they get it
from Greek. Oh, okay. I see where they're getting it from. But this is amikem. It's like A-M-K-M is what it is.
Yeah.
There's two M's. There's an Aleph and a Mem. And then there's a Kaf, which is a K sound, and a Mem.
Okay, I didn't want to slow things down too much, but thank you.
Yeah, it's just weird to me. That word is weird to me. I mean, I haven't investigated everything Hebrew. I've investigated a lot, but it's far from everything. I don't read Hebrew like I can Greek, right? I only had so many years in prison. I'm sorry.
Okay, you'll go back soon.
Wow, thanks a lot.
I'm kidding with you.
Isaiah 51. Verse 1. Hearken to me, ye that follow after righteousness, ye that seek Yahweh. Look unto the rock whence ye are hewn, and to the hole of the pit whence ye are digged.
Microphone muted.
Look unto Abraham, your father, and unto Sarah, that bare you. For I called him alone, and blessed him, and increased him. For Yahweh shall comfort Zion. He will comfort all her her waste places, and he will make her wilderness like Eden, and her desert like the garden of Yahweh. Joy and gladness shall be found therein, thanksgiving and the voice of melody. Hearken unto me, my people, and give ear unto me, O my nation. For a law shall proceed from me, and I will make my judgment to rest for a light of the people. My righteousness is near my salvation. My righteousness is near. My salvation is gone forth, and mine arms shall judge the people. The isles shall wait upon me, and on mine arm shall they trust. Lift up your eyes to the heavens, and look upon the earth beneath, for the heavens shall vanish away like smoke, and the earth shall wax old like a garment, and they that dwell therein shall die in like manner. But my salvation shall be forever, and my righteousness shall not be abolished. Hearken unto me, ye that know righteousness, the people in whose heart is my law. Fear ye not the reproach of men, neither be ye afraid of the revelings. For the moth shall eat them up like a garment, and the worm shall eat them like wool. But my righteousness shall be forever, and my salvation for generation to generation. Awake, awake, put upon strength, O arm of Yahweh. Awake, as in the ancient days, in the generations of old. Art thou not it that hath out Rahab, and wounded the dragon? Art thou not it which hath dried the sea, the waters of the great deep, that hath made the depths of the sea a way for the ransomed to pass over? End of verse 10.
Well, first, in verse 8, we see another reference to what Paul was citing in Hebrews chapter 1. And Paul was citing that because he was addressing Hebrews, but he was addressing Israelites in all of his epistles, even if a lot of people don't understand that, he was. Hearken unto me, ye that follow after righteousness, and ye that seek Yahweh, look unto the rock whence you are hewn, and unto the hole of the pit whence you are digged. And in verse 2, we have a Hebrew parallelism, which defines the rock and the hole. Look unto Abraham your father, and unto Sarah that bare you. So Abraham and Sarah are the rock and the hole where these people came from. And I don't know how these churches get off just discarding all this and interpreting Abraham's seed as something different when they read Romans chapter 4 or John chapter 8. They're just lying. They're just liars. They're always liars. They're always going to be liars unless you understand that Yahweh is addressing, that Yahweh is dealing with the same people that he put away in the Assyrian and Babylonian captivities. And anything else is a lie. There's no room for anything else in any of this language. O my nation, and the word is singular there. It's not plural. It can't be imagined that he's going to take many nations and make them into one nation. It can only be imagined that these are all the descendants of Abraham, and they were one nation in the first place. Even though they became many nations, they were still one nation in the first place. So his salvation is from generation to generation. When you count your race from generation to generation, you can't possibly ever include other races. How does that work? It don't work. It never works. In other words, everything in here refutes the Catholic Church. It refutes universalism. It refutes all of those concepts. The simple language of all of this refutes all of those concepts. I don't know if there's anything else I should talk about here.
Can y'all hear me? I'm trying to do this shit on Linux.
Yes, yeah, sir.
Victory!
So in verse 1, where it says, look unto the rock whence ye are hewn.
Yeah, in this case, it's a reference to Abraham.
Okay.
And verse 2 tells us that.
Not talking about some sort of like pre-substantiation, right?
No, it's retarded. Talking about Abraham. And verse 2 reveals that. Abraham's the rock, Sarah's the pit. It's a parallelism. I'm sorry, I'm kind of eating dinner.
Verse 11.
I'm sorry.
Verse 11?
Yes, sir.
Isaiah 51, verse 11. Therefore, the redeemed of Yahweh shall return and come with singing unto Zion. And everlasting joy shall be upon their head. They shall obtain gladness and joy and sorrow, and mourning shall flee away. I am he that comforteth you. Who art thou that thou shouldest be afraid of a man that shall die? And of the Son of Man, which shall be made as grass. And forgettest Yahweh thy Maker, that hath stretched forth the heavens, and laid the foundations of the earth, and hast feared continually every day because of the fury of the oppressor, as if he were ready to destroy. And where is the fury of the oppressor? The captive exile hasteneth that he may be loosened, that he may be loosed, and that he should not die in the pit, nor that his bread should fail. But I am Yahweh thy God, that divided the sea, whose waves roared. Yahweh of hosts is his name. And I have put my words in thy mouth, and I have covered thee in the shadow of mine hand, that I may plant the heavens and lay the foundations of the earth, and say unto Zion, thou art my people. Awake, awake, stand up, O Jerusalem, which hath drunk at the hand of Yahweh, the cup of his fury.
User entered your channel.
Thou hast drunken the dregs of the cup of trembling and wrung them out. There is none to guide her among all the sons whom she hath brought forth. Neither is there any that taketh her by hand of all the sons that she hath brought up. These two things are come unto thee. Who shall be sorry for thee? Desolation and destruction, and the famine and the sword. By whom shall I comfort thee? Thy sons have fainted. They lie at the head of all the streets as a wild bull in a net. They are full of the fury of Yahweh, the rebuke of thy God. Therefore, hear now this, thou afflicted and drunken, but not with wine. Thus saith Yahweh and thy God that pleadeth the cause of his people. Behold, I have taken out of thine hand the cup of trembling, even the dregs of the cup of my fury. Thou shalt no more drink it again. But I will put it into the hand of them that afflict thee, which have said to thy soul, bow down, that we may go over. And thou hast laid thy body as the ground and as the street to them that went over.
I'm sorry, my wife brought the dogs in. But the children of Israel have been addressed through Isaiah from chapter 41 to this point. But now he's doing an oracle against Jerusalem. Isaiah must be in Judah somewhere because all of Israel is brought into captivity. He must be in Judah, and he's talking against Jerusalem here. So this is still 115 to 120 years before Jerusalem is destroyed by the Babylonians and the Judahites, the last of Judah, remnant of Judah, are taken into captivity. And here he gives an oracle against Jerusalem and says it's going to be destroyed. Even though he promised that Yahweh promised that he would defend Jerusalem, I think it was Isaiah chapter 35. And Jerusalem survived the siege of the Assyrians. And Isaiah chapters 36, 37, 38. Now, in Isaiah chapter 51, we see an oracle against Jerusalem that is going to be destroyed. And the only way to understand that is in the historical context. That Isaiah chapters 35, 36, 37, 38, we're talking about the Assyrian siege of Jerusalem. But now Isaiah is looking towards the future, saying that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed in the future. And it happens 100 years later with the Babylonians, maybe 110 or 15 years later. All throughout this chapter, in verse 18 here, thou art my people, speaking to the children of Israel, even though Jerusalem's going to be destroyed. Desolation and destruction are going to come upon her, and she ain't going to be able to do anything about it. So it's a message of hope and despair at the same time, which is characteristic of these chapters. If y'all got anything to say or anything to ask, it's welcome.
So I'm wondering, when he made these prophecies about Judah, if there was anyone around who had any sort of understanding, well, than Isaiah, right? Or if even Isaiah had understanding.
Yeah, right. We'll never know. We'll never know that. But these are pretty harsh words for Judah, just a few years after Yahweh had saved Judah from the Assyrians.
Microphone activated.
Well, there were likely some. I mean, it was recorded.
By this time, And we don't see this too much in Isaiah. We do see it in Jeremiah, where Jeremiah is actually making these proclamations before the people of the city, and they just want to kill him. Isaiah must have been doing the same thing. He must have been. But Isaiah probably pretty much cemented his reputation as a prophet with the prophecy, the as birds flying prophecy, that Yahweh would defend Jerusalem, that Jerusalem would not be taken, even though 46 fenced cities of Judah were taken and most of the people of Judah were brought into captivity. Isaiah said that Jerusalem would not be taken, and it wasn't. And Hezekiah survived the siege, and he survived the time of his illness to live another 15 years, as it was promised. So everything that Isaiah said earlier in the history of his prophecy came true. By then, you'd think that the people weren't going to screw with them over anything he said, because they would just accept it and believe it was going to come true, like all the earlier stuff came true. And the earlier stuff did come true. So Isaiah is in a unique position among the prophets, because most of the things that Jeremiah prophesied were still far off in the future. And he probably didn't live to see their fulfillment. Isaiah, his ministry had to be at least 45 years. And he did see the fulfillment of a lot of things that he had prophesied earlier, such as the preservation of Jerusalem. So you're really sticking your neck out there when the enemy is surrounding the walls and they're pounding on your walls, and you're standing up and saying that God's going to defend Jerusalem, that it's not going to fall. And they're out there for a couple of years, but eventually they all die and they go away. So that must have cemented Isaiah's esteem among the people of Jerusalem. It must have, that he could say this and nobody opposed him, evidently. But yeah, people also did oppose Jeremiah. It is recorded in Jeremiah. When we get to Jeremiah, you'll see where people were in actual opposition to Jeremiah, and they put him in prison at one point. They wanted to kill him for the things he was saying.
Yeah, and just like Elijah, right? So there were only 7,000 at one point, which was probably out of at least a million, probably more.
Right.
And so he was infamous in his day. All the prophets must have been infamous. I mean, Samuel wasn't infamous. He was more like famous, but you know what I mean? So I would think that, these things were perhaps recorded a little bit later. Sure, they wrote things down, but then, yeah, people realized after they suffered that this guy was telling the truth and then started writing it down.
Right. I think Isaiah was a little different. He was probably infamous at first when he was forecasting the fall of Israel and the captivity, which he did. But then he probably became famous after Hezekiah survived and the Assyrian siege of Jerusalem failed. He probably enjoyed some fame for a little while, I would think.
Yeah.
That's the way the people are. They hate you when you tell them about bad things that are going to happen, even if they happen. If they happen, they blame it on you if you're still alive. But Isaiah told him that Jerusalem would be what would be saved, and it was. So I think he probably had a good report among the people. But that also facilitated his being able to give us these 26 chapters here. That's my opinion.
Microphone muted.
And now he's prophesying doom upon Jerusalem. Now they're probably hating him, even though he had been right in the past. Now I would bet they're hating him. You tell people good things are going to happen or bad things are going to happen, but they'll never accept the blame for themselves. They're all like children. They'll never accept responsibility for themselves.
Isaiah 52.
If you'll give me a minute, I'm sorry.
Take time.
I'm getting old. I'm sorry. I need a minute.
One of the things that's kind of interesting is in this first verse of 52, awake, awake, put on thy strength. The word strength is Strong's H5797, which is Oz, which means political strength or financial strength. And it's kind of interesting. Wonder if that was what Frank Baum was thinking when he wrote Wizard of Oz.
Well, wow, y'all could talk about something.
Actually, we just were. So
okay, cool. I just didn't hear it. I'm sorry.
So Isaiah 52, verse 1. Awake, awake, put on thy strength, O Zion, put on thy beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city. For henceforth, there shall no more come into thee uncircumcised and the unclean. Shake thyself from the dust, arise and sit down, O Jerusalem. Loose thyself from the bands of thy neck, O captive daughter of Zion. For thus saith Yahweh, ye have sold yourselves for naught, and ye shall be redeemed without money. For thus saith Yahweh God, my people went down aforetime into Egypt to sojourn there, and the Assyrians oppressed them without cause. Now, therefore, what have I here, saith Yahweh, that my people is taken away for naught? They that rule over them make them to howl, saith Yahweh, and my name continually every day is blasphemed. Therefore, my people shall know my name. Therefore, they shall know in that day that I am he that doth speak. Behold, it is I. How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation, that saith unto Zion, thy God reigneth. Thy watchmen shall lift up the voice, with the voice together shall they sing, for they shall see eye to eye, when Yahweh shall bring again Zion. Break forth into joy, sing together, ye waste places of Jerusalem. For Yahweh hath comforted his people. He hath redeemed Jerusalem. Yahweh hath made bare his holy arm in the eyes of all the nations, and all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our God. Depart ye, go ye out from hence. Touch no unclean thing. Go ye out of the midst of her. Be ye clean that bear the vessels.
User
of Yahweh.
In your channel timed out.
End of verse 11.
Wow. There's a lot going on here. I love Isaiah. If you read 26 chapters of Isaiah, and then you read John, and then you read the epistles of Paul, it's incredible how much like synchronization there is between them. It's incredible how they're explaining two ends of the same circumstance between Yahweh and the ancient children of Israel. And I could pick on the Judeo-Christian churches all day about this because they don't get it. They never got it, and they probably never will get it. They're too full of themselves. But this is just incredible. If you look at this and you look at the context in which Paul has spoken, and he cited this passage, he cited this chapter twice, once in Romans chapter 10, where he was referring to the apostles of Christ, and he said, "And how shall they preach except they be sent? As it is written, how beautiful the feet of them that preach the gospel of peace and bringeth glad tidings of good things." And he said, "But they not all obeyed the gospel, for Isaiah said, Lord, who has believed our report?" And that's coming soon, but Paul was quoting verbatim from these chapters of Isaiah when he said that. And then in 2 Corinthians, and we see that a little later on in this chapter, where it says, "Come out from her, my people," and
user entered your channel.
"Be ye clean, ye that bear the vessels of the Lord." The vessels of the Lord, they're not cups and bowls and saucers and bullshit like that. That they're your bodies. They're your Adamic bodies are the vessels of the Lord. And Paul was referring to that same verse in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. But when he said, "Wherefore," in verse 17, "wherefore come out from among them and be ye separate and touch not the unclean, and I will receive you." And the King James Version adds that word "thing," but that's just bullshit. Isaiah was talking about people and Paul was talking about people. It's talking about separating yourselves from the unclean people, not the unclean thing, as we see here in verse 11. The King James has that word "thing" in italics, meaning they added it in, but it's talking about people. And this is talking about the coming captivity and the captivity which already happened, the captivity of Israel, where they would be separated. He would come, he would drag them out, and they'd be separated from the unclean. In the context of Isaiah, they would come out and be separated from the unclean in their captivity. Where in the context of Paul, it's a corrupt world, and the children of Israel being called out of the nations to where they were scattered. So the same concept, it is in effect to come out from these unclean people. And this is the same concept we have today that we're called to do today. So we're going to hear "come out from among them" when the fall of Babylon comes in Revelation chapter 18. It's the same shit. Yahweh begging us to come out from among these aliens and separate ourselves so that we could do his will. It's the same thing. Three times in Isaiah's time, in Paul's time, and what we look for in the future. So here in Isaiah, we have a prophecy of the gospel. It was the apostles of Christ that brought good tidings. And the word gospel means good tidings. It means good news in Old English. and it publishes salvation, the account of the gospel is the publishing of the announcement of salvation for the children of Israel from Yahweh. And how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that brings good tidings, not because his feet are comely or beautiful, but because of what he's doing with them, because of how he's employing his feet, as Paul had basically walked over Anatolia, Macedonia, and Greece on at least two or three occasions. It's not that his feet look good, it's what he did with them that made them beautiful. So this chapter of Isaiah really is quite profound. Although Jerusalem stands as a type for his people and not necessarily for that city in Palestine in verse 9. And of course, the end of the chapter is a prophecy of Christ. And that'll continue into chapter 53. It continues to be a prophecy of Christ, even though it's in reference to the children of Israel. Verse 12 kind of evokes visions of the Exodus, where the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire had led the children of Israel out of Egypt.
One thing that I came across in verse 1, where it says the word strength, was that actually comes from the Hebrew word oz. And it can mean either, physical, financial, or political strength.
Okay, well, that's just like that word.
And so, I'm wondering if that's where Frank Baum got his inspiration for the Wizard of Oz.
Oh, I don't know. I really don't know.
Because, the whole thing, the as far as, like, money being backed with gold and silver and...
Yeah.
So, anyways.
Well, I mean, I guess the possibility is there, but he's a Jew anyway, so.
Is he?
Baum? I always thought so. Maybe I'm wrong, but I always thought so. With a name like Baum.
Yeah.
Microphone activated.
I know it's probably a German word, just like my name is German.
Yeah, it means tree.
But damn, those damn Jews steal everybody's name.
What, sure. What means tree?
Baum. B-A-U-M.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Like Tannenbaum?
Well, you know, this is it's a promise, not necessarily to Jerusalem. It's not to Jerusalem, the geographic location, but to Jerusalem, the concept is the capital of the people of Judah and of God's people. Even though in Isaiah 51, the destruction of Jerusalem was foretold, in Isaiah 52, Jerusalem and the captive daughter of Zion would be lifted out of the dust and restored in the gospel of Christ when that gospel is announced to them. And that's the story that Isaiah chapter 52 is telling. I mean, Assyrian oppressed them without cause. Yeah, you know, the cause was Yahweh's, but the cause really, the Assyrians had no reason. They were just out for their own gain and to conquer in their own power. So they themselves had no just cause.
And then we have the salvation of Christ, and then within a few centuries, we're back to accepting the usury of the Jewish merchants of Venice.
Yeah, well, that's all a matter of the revelation, right? It's all a matter of prophecy, because even though we had the salvation of Christ, the children of Israel were to go into punishment for seven times, which is at least 2,500 years, and Christ came only about 740 years after their punishment began. 760 years, maybe, after their punishment began. Okay, it was 750 years for the fall of Samaria to the crucifixion of Christ. 748 years, probably. So, well, we got 1,800 more years, right, from the time of Christ. And then we run into the Age of Liberty and the time of Jacob's trouble. That's how I reckon it. Maybe the future will prove me wrong. Maybe it'll prove me right. But that's how I would reckon it. That the period of punishment ended with the dawn of the Age of Liberty, when we thought we could rule ourselves, and we couldn't. We ended up in deeper shit thinking we could rule ourselves. And that's the time of Jacob's trouble. Because in truth, only God can rule us. And we're going to be punished until we realize that.
Activated. 1,800 years? Yeah, I think at the rate that we're at, that would be definitely a long stretch.
Yeah, well, that 1,800 years, I'm counting 2,520 years of punishment and deducting the time of that punishment before the coming of Christ, and there were 1,800 years left. The seven times couldn't fail. If Yahweh told the children of Israel they would be punished for seven times, it
which,
don't matter
which brings
if Christ
us up
comes,
to, which
that their punishment is going to continue. Our punishment continued.
Which brings us up to about the time that the beast was released from the pit with Napoleon.
That's my point.
Yeah, it actually
from
the first Assyrian captivity, it equals basically 1776 and 1789, 13 years in between them. Because 744 BC was roughly when the Assyrian captivity began, and by 731 it was ended.
Well, it wasn't really ended by 731, but Samaria fell in 721.
Okay.
But yeah, that's very, I mean, I talked about that in Christ-like, my first Revelation commentary. I hope to expand on it even more in my next, right? When I get to Revelation chapter 13. But that's still about right, David. That's how I would have to measure it. Even if our chronology is never perfect, our chronology isn't perfect. I mean, we could be off a few years very easily. That's just the way it is. If you read Diodorus Siculus and look at his chronology, it's off about 3 years from most other ancient Greek writers. And it really can't be accounted for, but it just is.
Yeah, and then they weren't actually let out of the pit, out of the ghetto necessarily, till like 1804 or something by Napoleon. So it's all in that area, though. It's
right.
That 25-year period of time or so.
For and me, it only has to be approximate because our chronologies are never perfect.
Right.
And what's interesting, what was that ghetto was in Venice. That's where the town of ghetto was, that it comes from.
That's probably where the word ghetto comes from, but there were such ghettos all over Europe. Because the Jews weren't allowed to live among the Christians. They were forced to live in separate sections or communities.
Microphone muted.
But that's been the way it is from ancient times. Ancient Athens had a special section set aside where non-citizens had to stay in that section when they visited the city. So that's where you found the inns, the hotels, the motels, whatever, that which were inns in the ancient world. That's where you found them. And that is also the circumstance with Rahab in Jericho and why her house was built into the wall of the city. Because that was not the ideal place to live. Most people wanted to live in the center of the city or closer to it. The wall of the city, what would be the first part that got attacked when the shit hit the fan, it would always be a problem area. It was always more traveled. The areas of these ancient cities where strangers were forced to live were always in the least desirable area, the city wall by the market. So Rahab catering to strangers, to sojourners who were visiting the city, she was probably a sojourner herself, and that's why I don't believe she was a Canaanite. I'll never believe she was a Canaanite, because she lived in that same section as an innkeeper. Which is why she needed all the flax on her roof to make linen, because she probably had a constant need for linen. So ancient Athens and most other ancient cities, or maybe all other ancient cities, had basically the same circumstances, where it was an area of the city designated for strangers. They weren't allowed to wander through town and go see what they wanted to see. Microphone activated. They probably would have got shot.
Yeah, and that makes sense, right? Because you wouldn't, like, in the ancient world, things were so dangerous. You wouldn't let some guys who just came in for trade or whatever purpose just go wherever they want. You want to know where they are. So if there's a problem, where are the foreigners? And it's simple to find them. They're in this area. You wouldn't just, it's not like today where I can go to Amsterdam and just do whatever the hell I please.
Right. That was unheard of in the ancient world.
That's why it used to be like in Boston up until the 70s.
Come on, that, really?
That if blacks went into certain areas, they shouldn't be in like Charlestown or whatever. They get jumped if they were there after dark.
Yeah, they had that in New Jersey too, Martin. They had that all over the North and the South. Yeah. They had sunset towns. If a nigger got muted. Caught in town after sunset, he either got his ass lynched or he went to jail, depending on who caught him.
Don't let the sun set on your black ass in this town.
Yeah. Sunset towns, right.
Yeah.
Because you know if they're there after sunset, they're only there to do crime.
Yeah, same thing in South Africa as well.
It's the way it should be.
They had these bells that would go off, and when the bells went off, they had to get out.
Well, I would rather live in a swamp in the backwoods of Florida. Yeah, if I saw a nigger at night, I know he'd be up to no good. I'd want to shoot his ass. Yes, sir. I'd take him right down the river with my goat and feed him with my boat and feed him regators. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that on a recording, but I did.
Alligator bait.
Yeah, that they if you, you see you, outsiders you were talking, you were talking in a little about town at night, what do they belong there? What are they doing? They don't belong there. So you know they're up to no good. And people back in the day,
they're jogging
100 years ago, they understood that, and they understood that they had to defend their town from potential criminals. Yeah, today we don't understand that. We've lost that. That the Jewish media has bred it out of us. It's right on Wikipedia. And Wikipedia, they're called sundown towns, right? Towns.
They're just there to jog.
Yeah, right. They're just jogging my ass. That motherfucker wasn't no jogger. Armed robbery, Ahmed Arbery, armed robbery, he was no jogger. Sundown towns, also known as sunset towns, gray towns or sundowner towns, are all white municipalities or neighborhoods in the United States that practice a form of racial segregation by excluding non-whites via some combination of discriminatory local laws, intimidation, or violence. The term came from the signs that posted colored people had to leave town by sundown. Well, yeah, right. They didn't live there, so get the fuck out of our town by sundown. That's not discrimination. That's common sense self-protection.
Yeah.
It's dark. Go the fuck home, nigger. Go home. Stay on your fucking cotton plantation.
There's a place up near Dallas, Fort Worthless area up there in Texas called White Settlement. And yep, it was White Settlement back in the day.
Microphone activated.
White Cinnamon.
Yeah, something happened there, settlement. Right? Recently, Culture Critic, like a couple of years ago, wasn't there a shooting?
I don't know. Shootings all the time around here in Texas.
No, I meant like a mass shooting. White Settlement. Okay.
Don't know, sir.
Maybe I'll look it up. I might be wrong.
Is that one that Oprah was talking about?
No, I think that some guy went into a church or something.
Oh, but... yeah, the Hindu Sikh church or whatever?
Yeah, like I think I recall that because my sister lives in that area, and that's when it caught my attention.
Microphone muted.
Okay, verse 12.
Yeah, I'm looking at this article where sundown towns are named in Louisville, Kentucky, and Ferguson, Missouri. Imagine that.
That's like that book, To Kill a Mockingbird, right? Well, the mockingbird, if you live down south, mockingbirds, they chase around all the blackbirds, yeah. the bigger blackbirds. And the mockingbird is the state bird of like five or seven southern states. That's where they got the title for the book.
Levittown, New York was a sundown town. It's named on here. I know they had them in Jersey. I know they had them everywhere. But they're just not all mentioned here. Where I lived in Bayonne, New Jersey, and I moved from Jersey City to Bayonne when we were six. When I was 16, my parents moved us. In Bayonne, if you were caught after dark and you were from Jersey City, the cops would run you out. If you were from Jersey City. If you lived in Bayonne, that was okay. The cops wanted to get to know you. They got to know me too well. They stole my Jack Daniels all the time. They stole
User
my pot.
On your channel, time down.
I'm sorry.
Microphone
but,
activated.
Yeah, they got to know me too well, but they never ran me out because I lived there.
User entered your channel.
But they never locked me up either.
They never found your beer either. Right.
Well, I didn't carry around a whole lot of beer, but I used to carry around a fifth of Jack Daniels sometimes or a quarter ounce of marijuana or something. Yeah. They'd always catch me and give me a hard time and just take my shit and let me go all the time. I was 16, 17. I was a wayward youth, right?
Okay, speaking of being wayward, chapter 12, verse 12.
Okay.
Verse 12. For ye shall not go out with haste, nor go by flight.
User
For Yahweh will go
out.
Before you, and the God of Israel will be your reward.
In other words, he's going to watch your back, right?
Behold, my servant shall deal prudently. He shall be exalted and extolled and be very high, as many were astonied at thee. His visage was so marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. So shall he sprinkle many nations. The kings shall shut their mouths at him, for that which had not been told them shall they see, and that which they had not heard shall they consider.
Okay.
So foreshadowing Christ.
Yeah, yes, but I really believe that a lot of these prophecies are very profound in the fact that they have double meanings. They have double meanings. And I'll get to that in a moment. In one aspect, it's talking about the children of Israel, about Jacob, right? Because they're being taken into captivity. Israel's in Assyrian captivity, and most of Judah is with them, with Israel, and Jerusalem is prophesied here back in chapter 51 that it's going to be destroyed and that they're also going into captivity. So here it's talking about a release from captivity and how they are going to be exalted and extolled, right? That they're going to go from being the bottom of the nations, the least of nations, because they're taken into captivity by the Assyrians and Babylonians, that they're going to be exalted and extolled. And it's talking about Jacob and Christ at the same time, in my opinion. That this is definitely a prophecy of Christ, but it's also a prophecy of how Yahweh God is going to treat Jacob. Because the subject is Jacob, the subject is the Israelites, to verse 12. But then in verses 13 and 15, we being Christians can understand it's speaking about Christ, but it's also still speaking about Jacob, and it has a dual meaning. And that word sprinkle, naza, to spurt, spatter, sprinkle, to spring, or to leap, that can have either meaning. To sprinkle, like with blood, the blood of a sacrifice, right? Christ sprinkled many nations. He sprinkled all the nations of the children of Israel with the blood of his sacrifice to cleanse them of their sin, to forgive them of their sins, right? He did that. But it can also mean to cause to leap or to startle many nations, and the children of Israel from their captivity took over Europe. They startled and leapt upon many nations. So it's a dual fulfillment. It refers to Christ, but it also refers to Jacob. Is that understandable?
10-4.
Microphone active.
Yeah, also,
you entered your channel.
It'd be great to get some feedback from somebody else besides Martin and David, but that's okay. What's up, David? I'm glad you're talking.
So it's a double meaning. And in 14, it says his visage was so marred. And earlier in Isaiah, like many chapters earlier, he speaks of the fact that Christ was not a handsome man. If you recall.
No, that's, I think, later. I think you're talking about maybe Isaiah 56, which is coming.
Okay, sorry. But
I believe that's what you're talking about, which is fine. And that is a prophecy of Christ, without doubt. But this is a dual prophecy. It could refer to Jacob or Christ, because when Jacob was deported into captivity, and if you understand where the kingdom of Israel was in the ancient world at the time of David and Solomon, that was the most powerful nation in the world. And then by the time of the Assyrian captivity, it was just disgraced compared to his former stature.
Right.
So, yeah, Jacob was marred worse than any man in that respect.
Especially since the other nations must have viewed them as being marred because they fell from such a high point, let's say in the time of David and Solomon, to what they were later.
Well, right. I sincerely believe that in the minds of the Assyrians and the Egyptians, they witnessed the children of Israel go from the height to the depth. They had to be aware of it. They had to see that happening. Just as European nations today, I mean, Europe, the same shit that's happening to us today is happening in Europe. Don't get me wrong. And in Canada and everywhere else. But America, the most powerful nation on earth in 1948, is now a shithole country in 2021. And it's on its way down. And when it happens, all the other white nations, or all the other aware white people are going to witness that. Even Americans are going to witness that and understand it. That we went from the height to the depth in so many decades. So that, what I'm saying is that the Egyptians, the Assyrians, the Philistines, the Syrians, and the other people around ancient Israel must have seen the same process. And they must have recognized it to some degree. I mean, they did have histories that they weren't ignorant people, that they understood. They must have understood that in 700 BC, they must have understood that in 900 BC or 1000 BC, Israel was the greatest nation under David and Solomon. And by 700 BC, they must have had memories of that handed down to them. But now Israel is like a laughingstock in 698 BC, and it's going down even further. That they must have been conscious of that, the neighbors of the ancient Israelites, and a lot of Israelites themselves must have been conscious of that.
I think we can all agree that throughout antiquity and even, you know, up to today, you see how these great empires, so to speak, fall because of a lack of homogeneity, right?
Yeah, right. Well, that's a big part of it, yeah. You mix a few niggers in there and you create a lot of divisions among the people. I mean, I experienced that in my life. I mean, when I was 5, 6 years old, in Jersey City, of all places, my experience was like Mayberry. All the adults in the neighborhood knew me. They all knew my name. They all looked out for me. I took the bus back and forth to kindergarten at 5 years old. Never had a problem. But when the bus let me off a block late, the mailman helped me get back home. I mean, I had all kinds of experiences like that where everybody, where all the adults were kind and looked out for you, and the other kids were kind to you and never gave you a hard time, and nobody ever tried to feel me up or molest me, right? I mean, it was a different world in Jersey City. You think, if you understood what I'm trying to say, you'd think I grew up in Podunk, North Carolina. It was no different than Mayberry, I swear. But by 1974, when after all the nigger chimp outs in the late 60s and all the urban blight, niggers moving in everywhere, and all the white flight and whites fleeing the city, white people were alienated from one another because they were alienated from everybody. The injection of other races into our neighborhoods and our society alienated us from one another as well as from the other races. It just put everybody, it forced everybody to go into a shell. I remember walking up to a woman, and I was about 17 years old, and I was in a busy place on the streets of Manhattan. And I asked a white woman what time it was because I really didn't know. I didn't have a watch. I got off the train late. The train was jammed up. I was at Madison Square Garden. I asked a woman what time it was, and she turned and ran from me. And I'm like, what the fuck? I couldn't believe that. But it happened, and it was not the response I expected. I'm a white kid asking a white woman what time it was, and she turned and ran from me. I'm like, what the fuck did she think I was going to do to her? I was like, 16 years old, 17 years old. But that process of integration in the 60s and 70s, it really alienated everybody from one another. It really did. It divided our communities. It destroyed them. It destroyed any sense of community. In the mid 60s, I can remember in Jersey City, the Anglo neighborhood, the German neighborhood, the Italian neighborhood, the Polish neighborhood. And then they started, the nigger population exploded. And they started moving all these Puerto Ricans and Cubans in, and spics were everywhere, and niggers were everywhere, and there weren't any neighborhoods. Every neighborhood was fucked in a short time, within 10 years.
Let me ask you this. In Jersey, was it the Jewish areas that turned into the nigger areas?
Yeah, because the Jews fled. The Jews all went out of town.
Or it was planned.
Yeah. The Jews all went to Ridgewood or Point Pleasant or Maplewood or some other town, Lyndhurst.
And then they sold all to all the niggers.
Yes. Yes, they did. There was a huge Jewish factor involved. Yes, there was.
User disconnected from.
And the Jews were the first to do white flight, but they weren't white. But they were the first out. So by the time I was 17, there was still, by the time I was 16, there were still three Jewish delis in Bayonne. But I bet by the time there was 19, maybe 18, they all burned down. Every one of them burned down. Imagine that.
Jewish lightning.
Yeah, absolutely.
User entered
three Jewish delis in town, and within a couple of years, they all burnt down. And my father said it was Jewish lightning. That's where I first heard that term, was from my dad, because he knew what was going on.
I don't know how it was back up in the north area up there, but like up until certainly 68 in Texas, you would still hear sonic booms from the Air Force, the Air National Guard and such, because it was unrestricted at that time. Kind of a thing of the past.
Yeah, we only heard, I only remember sonic booms from Kennedy Airport. I grew up right in the middle of three major airports, which is why New York City doesn't have the biggest airport in the world, because there's three airports that are all separate, two in New York City and one in New Jersey. There's LaGuardia, Kennedy, and Newark. So if they were one airport, they would be the biggest airport in the world, but they can't have it all in one airport up there. So I only remember sonic booms from Kennedy Airport. There were a couple of military airports around, but I can't remember sonic booms from jet fighters. I didn't even see a lot of jet fighters when I was a kid. I didn't really see jet fighters. I only saw airport transport planes were big. I never saw jet fighters, I remember, in that area. But the sonic booms used to come from the Concords out of Kennedy Airport, which was really about 6 miles across the water, 7 miles across the water from where I live. I'm guessing it might have been a few more, but we heard sonic booms from there all the time. Now that I'm in Florida, we hear booms constantly. We hear, I don't know if they're sonic booms or if they're that they're explosions from the missile range the airport has here, but we're right in between two military air bases here, Eglin and Tyndall. And we see jet fighters all the time, as a matter of course.
Microphone activated.
And their Asian wives.
I'm sorry?
And the pilots' Asian wives.
Yeah, that they're all married to gooks. All, the whole Air Force marry gooks. They're all useless. They all marry gooks.
I mentioned that once.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And I saw it, and I was only there for I was there twice, and I saw it, like, guys, and I could say, like, fuck, you know.
If you go anywhere on the beach in Walton County or in Bay County, Florida, you go where, anywhere that the Air Force guys from Eglin or Bay or Tyndall frequent, you'll see all these white guys with gook wives. It's crazy.
And
it's absolutely, it's disgraceful.
And they're like young guys and they're fit. And like, yeah, you would think that they would have, you know, a normal white woman, but nope.
Yep. Get any white girl they want, but they got gooks. It's incredible.
Microphone muted.
It's a disgrace.
Hey, David, should we wrap up the recording?
Microphone activated.
Okay. It's up to Bill.
Where did we leave off? Did we finish chapter 52?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah, I said, I think I said everything I want to say. I say.